Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Okay, before we talk with my awesome father-in-law, because he really is, this is such a good episode. I love it. But we got to remind you, Paleo Valley, so good. These beef sticks I'm obsessed with, and everyone around me, anywhere I go. It was so funny. We were on a hike and I kept telling people like, oh, if you need something, I've got beef sticks. And they thought I was joking, but I literally carry them with me all the time. And they were in my backpack. And the moment I pulled it out for myself, everyone's like, oh my gosh, you really do. Can I have it? Can I have it? And they're so delicious. The jalapeno is my favorite. But what I love about Paleo Valley, because you get this easy snack, but it's protein. It's well sourced. It's grass fed, grass finished. You know what's in it. So this is why I love Paleo Valley. It's the easiest thing to be able to stick in your backpack. I use it for travel. I use it for hiking. I use it for everything. And it just really keeps me fueled, keeps me feeling good. And I know that I have something that I can take with me anywhere. So go check out Paleo Valley. You get 15% off when you use code OPTIMAL. So we have the link available for you. If you just check the show notes, click that link, check out Paleo Valley. Grab the beef sticks. I'm telling you, it's the best of the best out there.
All right, I'm just so excited to dive into this next interview. It's one Jen and I have wanted to do for a while. One of my greatest life teachers in both medicine, but also just humanity and how to treat people. It's my dad, Dr. Americo Fraboni. And I could dive into all of the training he went to and all the schooling. He's a board certified family medicine physician, and he specializes in OB, so he delivers lots of babies, but he is just an expert kind of in the status of pregnancy and delivery in America, especially working in a rural community for decades. My dad has so much experience in helping women go through this stage in life. So if you're pregnant, if you're looking to become pregnant, and you're looking for tips and tricks on how to navigate this process, he is an amazing person to get those tips from. He also talks about just the status of healthcare in our country, access to pregnancy and neonatal care. Everything. He is a wealth of knowledge. We dive into so much in this episode. We're so excited to share this with you. So here we go. So excited, Dad, to have you on the podcast.
Well, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
That's fun. Just we've been talking about having you on here, and so excited to have you on as MD, as someone who does family practice, has for a long time specialty in OB, so delivering lots of babies. And you know, there's a lot of conversations we can have around that, and we're super excited to dive in with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I really am open to whatever questions you have, and I'll try to answer the best that I can and use my expertise to do that.
Every time we have a conversation about, you know, diving into the hospital and birth life and all of that stuff, I always feel like, oh my gosh, we need to have the headphones on and be recording this.
Always have the headphones with us so that we can play, just because I know that we've captured like a couple podcasts just in our conversations with you.
We have. And that's why we've wanted to have you on, because I think it's important information for people to hear. Because even in my understanding, which isn't as obviously as vast, but just what I've learned having friends in pelvic health and stuff like that, and watching documentaries and trying to understand myself, it's like, I feel like there's always a bias one way or another. It's like, go have your baby naturally and with a midwife and at home, or have your baby at the hospital and have a C-section. You know, it's like, I feel like there's just this or that.
And that's true. I mean, OB is very contentious. There is a lot of opinions on how it should be done, where it should be done. And it depends on who you talk to. You have lay midwives that deliver babies at home or in a birthing center outside of a hospital setting. They're not registered nurses. They don't have any other medical background. Then you have registered nurses that train to be midwives. And they typically will deliver in a birthing center under the auspices of doctors that will back them up if something goes wrong. Then you've got OBGYNs, who that's what they specialize in. So they deliver lots of babies. They do a lot of gynecologic surgery. And then you have family medicine doctors who essentially take care of all age groups, starting from, we say it's cradle to grave. You know, we deliver the babies, we raise them with the families, we take care of them when they get older, and we bury them when they die. And so, and there's a lot of competition between the different groups, and sometimes they get along well, better in some areas of the country than in others. But certain parts of the country, it's a battlefield.
And that's what you do, right?
That's what I do. I'm a family medicine doctor. So I did a training for 3 years in family medicine, and then I did a 2-year surgical obstetrical fellowship. So I did extra training so I could do high risk obstetrics. I do C-sections. I do laparoscopic procedures. I do a lot of other surgery that the average family medicine doctor does not do. But that's what my interest really was in, and I really wanted to focus on that.
Mm-hmm. I've done a C-section.
Oh, God.
I just have to throw that in there.
He has.
A lot of FaceTime right now for all the awesome things you do. But funny story, this is one of my two truths and a lies, is I have delivered a baby C-section before. And
when you were 13.
When I was 13, yes. And when we were in Ecuador, one of the coolest memories I think I'll ever have growing up, we were at a hospital that didn't have a lot of workers, and they needed people to run in and out of the operating room. And my brother Angelo and I got to assist on a C-section with my dad, which was super cool.
Actually, having you and your brother in the operating with me, you know, you were 13, he was 16, probably one of the proudest times in my life, because how often do you get to have your kids by you in an operating room seeing what you do?
Yeah.
And it was such a proud moment, and to hand the baby over to you as we're taking it out of the uterus.
Squeegee out its nose and mouth.
I know. It's just like, you know, and when I think back on it, is that how many 13-year-olds see that kind of anatomy in the first place and then get to experience it in a surgical suite? You know, it's was amazing and just truly a great memory for me also.
Yeah, you're getting me all emotional in the first 10 minutes. I didn't think we would cry until at least minute 40 of this one.
I know. We're crybabies, but that's okay.
That really one of the coolest memories I was able to have too, and just to know the honor of working on someone's body like that, and the way that you really approach it with a thing of respect and working with the patient, has always been something that has inspired me coming into schooling and stuff. And yeah, being able to look at pictures of holding the baby with the mama in the recovery room afterwards, and the gratitude they had for the access to that kind of care that they otherwise wouldn't have had. Really cool experience for me to have at 13. I think had a little influence into why I've kind of developed in the way I have with medicine, and just with this understanding of how we need to find a way to do things in our country to get people access to a lot of these things. Right. I know that's what we are going to talk a little bit about, of is that access bit. One thing I want to mention about your training too. You talked about, you know, having this training, but you also have told us about a unique experience you had training with a midwife, or learning from that kind of point of view on pregnancy. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Absolutely. So I did my residency program through the University of Minnesota Community Hospital Program. So there were 5 different hospitals that were under the auspice of the University of Minnesota. Most were community hospitals. And the one that I practiced at or trained at was St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Paul. And they had a very robust midwife program that was run underneath the OBGYN department. But we were the only residency program there. And so we were it. They didn't have medical students. It was the residents, the practicing physicians, and then the nurse midwives. And they really liked to work with us. They encouraged us to come in on their deliveries. And that was a really unique situation, because most of the time there's very distinct lines drawn in each department. Family medicine docs deliver with family medicine docs. You know, nurse midwife students will deliver with the nurse midwives or work with the OBGYNs. And the program at St. Joseph's was very unique because we worked hand in hand with the OBGYNs. They were very good to us. We had community family medicine doctors that delivered babies. And then we had this large group, probably 8 or 10 nurse midwives, that brought in hundreds of deliveries to the hospital every year. And they taught us. And it was awesome because their perspective on managing pregnancy and particularly labor is just so different. They spend their entire time with the patient, you know, from when labor starts to when the baby's out. And it was really good to see their techniques. I still use some nurse midwife techniques when I'm delivering patients that I remembered from my residency training. I also had the opportunity to work with nurse midwives at my fellowship. The program wasn't as robust, so we didn't have as many of them coming in to do the deliveries, but they were very open to working with us again. I learned a lot of information and a lot of really hands-on techniques that enhance delivery experiences for both me and particularly for the patient.
I think that's so cool. I love when you first told me that too, because it automatically clears that line in the sand of this or that hospital or midwife and allows you to see there can be crossover. And there's a lot of the fact that you took the opportunity to learn from them. They took the opportunity to learn from you guys, and there was crossover in that. I think that's so amazing. Unfortunately, you said that doesn't happen a whole lot.
It doesn't. And I think there was a large midwife program through the University of Minnesota at the Riverside Hospital that was really good for many years. And then as practitioners change and opinions change, things fall apart, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's unfortunate when people don't see the mutual benefit that we all give to each other by working collaboratively. And I think I love that word, because anytime I worked with a midwife or an OBGYN, I felt that I was working collaboratively with them to get to a positive outcome, a healthy baby, a healthy mom. Unfortunately, in the United States, there's a lot of training that goes on that certain groups don't think other groups should be doing deliveries.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and I'm not going to point fingers at all the OBGYNs, because there are some wonderful OBGYNs out there that love to work with family medicine doctors and can work together. But in a lot of the training programs, they are trained to think that nobody else should be doing deliveries other than an OBGYN.
Yeah.
And so it really makes it a bit contentious if you get into an area where that is really flourishing, that thought. And that's why I chose to practice where I am, because in this rural community, we're it. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have OBGYNs up here for years, or they would come up on a consultation basis. And that helped us really work together. I mean, I have a great relationship with the maternal fetal medicine doctors, which are the specialists in OBGYN for high-risk pregnancies. So we use them to enhance our practices, to really get good information for our higher-risk patients. And then sometimes we'll co-manage, and they'll give us their opinion on what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. And most of the time, we're right on the mark. But yeah, it's like, oh, I didn't think of it that way. So again, they're educating us. We're supplying really good care to our patients who don't have to drive an hour or 2 hours to a specialist to get their care.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, it's a crazy concept, collaborating in healthcare.
So but, weird.
And in all fields, I feel like we talk about these turf battles. I mean, you brought it up, like there's different professions that are kind of like at a crossroads within certain turf, which I think is crazy when we refer to turf battles, when really that's talking about humans, healthcare, and exactly. It should just be something that we're looking to provide the best of for people. And it's kind of an unfortunate thing, because as you pointed out, it has nothing to do with the individual people within that profession. It has a lot to do with how this system steers the competition with healthcare dollars, with money that is put in to support different types of services or techniques. And I know that we've had a lot of conversations about how access to healthcare can be a huge component, specifically in mothers giving birth.
Absolutely. Access to care is one of the biggest risks to a healthy pregnancy.
Mm.
In areas where you've got private insurance, you know, so women who have private insurance have access.
Mm-hmm.
They can go to whichever plan, you know, whichever clinic or hospital that their plan covers, but it's usually decent coverage and good access. There are lots of women in the United States, particularly in underserved areas where there's a lot of brown skin people, Native Americans, who don't have the same access. Rural areas, terrible access for a lot of people. In northern Minnesota, up along the Great Lakes area, there are some communities that have to drive 2 to 3 hours to access prenatal care and a facility that will deliver them.
Hmm. Because that's just wild.
Yeah, hospital's been closed, or just the birthing center of the hospital has been closed because of low volumes or whatever. But the access is really, really poor for a lot of Americans, particularly in rural areas and in inner city areas. So it's really unfortunate, because that's what causes increased morbidity and mortality. You know, in the United States, you would think that we would have one of the lowest infant mortality rates in the world, and we're terrible. Yeah. Our infant mortality rate is terrible in the United States compared to some of the other developed countries. And a lot of it is because of access. If you don't get prenatal care that's adequate, you're at higher risk for preeclampsia, for diabetes, for, you know, placental abruption, for premature birth, which leads to lots of morbidity with the baby, and premature delivery with death, you know. So it's terrible.
That it, I mean, it's just so sad to hear. And I think it's awakening. Like, we need to hear this information, though, so that we understand how we can all work together to hopefully help the system do a little bit better. And I know that you talked about fetal monitoring as well.
Yes.
And something that hasn't necessarily helped rates of fetal birth, even.
Right. So, you know, fetal monitoring has been around for a number of years, especially since I've been training. You know, 30 years, fetal monitoring is just the standard. But when I first started training, you had the option of doing intermittent auscultation, which would mean when a woman would come into labor and delivery, if she was a low-risk pregnancy, you could just listen with a fetoscope or a Doptone, a little monitor, and get a 30 to 60 second heart rate, and then let the woman labor. She could be in the tub, she could be up walking, she could be doing more things that would help progress her labor in a more natural way. And then as time has progressed, continuous fetal monitoring has become more of the norm, because then you're watching the fetal heart rate continuously for any potential dips in the heart rate or concerns in the monitor strip, so that you can take action to intervene. So the advent of continuous monitoring was to try to minimize the risk to the fetus and improve infant mortality, and it really hasn't. Mm. There hasn't been any significant change in morbidity or mortality with the advent of continuous fetal monitoring. The only thing that's really changed is that our C-section rates have gone up dramatically. You know, nationwide in the United States, the C-section rate is greater than 30%. So more than 30% of women end up having a primary C-section, or a C-section in general, because of disconcerting monitor strip, a failure to progress, you know, a failure to dilate, things like that. And so we really haven't done any favors with fetal monitoring as far as infant mortality.
Do you think that we should go back?
I think we need a blend. Okay. I think we need to use a combination. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of women who, when they're doing well, they want to be off the monitor so they can walk, so they can be in a tub. And I think if you've got a reassuring monitor strip, you know, 20 minutes of a monitor strip that looks great, that's reassuring that the baby's doing well. Mm-hmm. And then periodic checks, if that baby's doing well, you can continue to do that periodic monitoring like that. But the liability and the litigious state of our country, it really makes people nervous to intermittently monitor moms who are in labor.
So, well, especially if you have the technology, and then if you don't do it and something happens, it's...
You're liable.
Yeah.
This is like another case that I feel is of you're deciding the intervention by this bit of information you're getting from technology.
Yep.
And so you're doing this intervention just in case the worst were to happen, where I feel like you see a lot with MRIs and stuff, where people get MRIs of joints and they see how bad the joint looks. When your joint's been progressing like that your whole life, and you may have had a torn meniscus or may have had some frays in your rotator cuff, but now that you have an MRI that says my rotator cuff is torn, or I need it fixed, I feel like we've seen dramatic increases in just simple orthopedic surgery is like this for the same reason. Once you have that bit of information, it gets you nervous. You need to do something, because then if your patient has a much worse tear in their rotator cuff and you didn't do something because you knew there was a small tear or something like that, the litigation bit.
Yeah. And yeah. If you look at the literature with like meniscal repairs and stuff like that, the outcomes aren't great.
Yeah. Right.
That's the thing.
So with surgery versus more conservative therapy. So I agree. I think we do, because of technology, you know, if somebody hurts their ankle, I want an MRI.
Yeah.
You don't need an MRI. Well, my insurance will pay for it. You don't need it, you know?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. so we have to balance the desire to have something done versus the actual need to have something done.
Totally.
So, and I'll tell you stories of labor and delivery where we're watching a monitor strip and you're seeing these dips in the heart rate, which are called decelerations. And the strip looks really concerning. It's like, oh my gosh, we got to get this patient to the operating room. And you're expecting a baby that's compromised. You bring the baby out and it screams at you like it's like, what the hell did you do to me? You know, and that's the baby that we want.
Yeah.
So strips don't always correlate well with how a baby's truly doing inside. And that's why the C-section rates have gone up so high, because you see a strip, it's a category 2 or a category 3 strip. And it's like, oh, we have to intervene somehow. And then you have this baby that's absolutely beautiful.
Wow.
Now, on the converse, if you don't act on that and you wait too long and you deliver a baby that's truly compromised and then has some morbidity associated with it, your ass is grass. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So, and I think I mentioned this earlier when we were talking before we started recording, it's CYA. It's cover your ass. Mm-hmm. So, because of the litigious state of the people in the United States and worldwide, you need to make sure that you're doing something safe for the patient and not putting them or their child at risk.
Right. Now, what about when a woman is, well, I know there's the ability to just schedule my C-section and I don't want to go through labor, so can I just schedule my C-section?
So that request is getting more and more common over the last 10 years. You know, 25 years ago when I was doing my fellowship, or actually almost 30 years ago, if you had a C-section, you automatically had a trial of labor. You had no real voice in that decision-making because the pendulum swings. Mm-hmm. You know, in the 1950s, if you had a C-section, all the rest of your deliveries were C-section because they thought that a scar on the uterus would cause rupture in labor and babies would die, moms would die. With research that had, you know, based on women who presented to the hospital too late for a repeat C-section, they delivered successfully vaginally, they got more and more data on rupture rates with C-sections, you know, one C-section versus two C-sections. So you gather that information. And then in the 1990s, it was like, oh, anybody who's had a C-section, the low transverse C-section, can have a trial of labor. Mm. If they cut the uterus up and down vertically, those rupture rates were terrible.
Mm.
10 to 12%, you know, so never had a trial of labor with those. So now it's kind of a mix. If you've had a previous C-section and you just electively want to have a repeat C-section, we'll do that for you because that's a reasonable request. Women who have had a C-section for an emergency situation, like the baby was breech and they didn't want to deliver breech, or the baby was having heart, you know, decelerations and we had to deliver the baby because of fetal compromise. Those women are very good candidates for trials of labor. And so I really encourage what's called a TOLAC, a trial of labor after cesarean. Mm. So we present all of those cases to our OB committee and we screen for those women who are at higher success rates. And our TOLAC rate or VBAC rate at the hospital that I work at is over 80% based on our being selective with those women. Now, if you've had more than one C-section, that risk of rupture is terribly high and you can have some tragedies associated with that. But somebody, say, Jen, if you were pregnant and you said, ah, I don't want the thought of having to deliver vaginally, I just want to have a C-section. That's an option. You know, and so the problems with today's society is that if you come in and say, I know I don't want to deliver vaginally, I just don't want to have that vaginal trauma, I want to have a scheduled C-section, and I don't do that for you, and I force you to have a vaginal delivery, or I highly encourage you to, and then something goes wrong, I'm liable.
Right.
So again, you have to balance that. What's safe, what's not safe, and what's reasonable. So I spend more time educating women and their partners in the office about what we could try or what's reasonable to try. And it takes way longer than just saying, yep, I'll schedule your C-section. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of women whose fears are a little unrational. And so when you talk to them about, well, tell me why, what is your fear about delivering vaginally? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of women, they just fear doctors. They have had bad experiences with doctors, particularly women with male doctors, you know. We get a bad rap sometimes because we're aggressive, we're not as gentle as we should be at times, and we may not take the time to educate women on what they need to hear. So you really need to educate and be kind.
Yeah.
And ask them what they're afraid of, because sometimes it's like, oh, let me explain this to you. I can give you some information or data on this, and then you are better informed. And there are a lot of women that's like, oh, well, if we can do it that way, well, I think I'd like to give it a try. It's a balancing act.
Yeah.
But I think if you're sincere and you truly want to what's best for that woman, she's going to know that. And she's...
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you said, that caring edge that sometimes a male OBGYN might not show in the room, especially in our system where you don't have a ton of time and you don't want to sit there and listen to everybody's story, but that's sometimes all they need is listening to that story. And talking a bit into like where those fears even come from. I think, again, when we popularize pregnancy, whether it's in Hollywood or whether it's on different birthing videos, it's always depicted as something that's so painful or traumatic or insane. Like, it's what makes the screen go and what makes a movie good. But on the flip side of that coin, you hear about people who do like this meditation around their pregnancy or birthing meditation. And even Megan, my sister-in-law, your daughter-in-law, has talked about her birthing processes and how they can be relatively painful and how that's the mindset that they've gone with the whole time. And what do you think about those two different kind of depictions of what pregnancy can be like?
There's a huge dichotomy there. I mean, there are women who, at the first sign of a contraction, are asking for pain medications or epidurals because they fear that pain. It's the fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. I had a delivery this past weekend, her first baby. She was petrified. But she, you know, I came in and I talked to her about pain management. What is available, what she can do, when she can get it. Sometimes just putting that onus on the patient that you can have this whenever you want it or whenever you feel you need it takes so much stress away from them, you know. So she got her epidural at like 3 centimeters, but she was thrilled at how it worked. She had no pain. She progressed beautifully. She, when it came time to pushing, she felt pressure, which scared her. And she was crying, but the minute she felt the pressure of my fingers down on her perineum and the reassurance that this is pressure, it's a different type of sensation, you can do this, she pushed the baby out in like 6 minutes. Wow. Oh no, actually she was a little over 20 minutes, but first baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she had a great experience and she was just so thankful. Whereas if you came in and, you know, I've seen some people handle situations like that where they're just so mean, you know, just push, or, you know, they just don't take that time to be kind.
Yeah.
And it really is. You have to reassure them that they're going to do wonderful, you know, that they're going to do great. And that if something's not working, we'll try something else. I mean, I joke with women all the time that I would be walking into the hospital backwards with my back bared, ready for the epidural because I don't like pain. I said, I know my limitations. So I tell them, you can have whatever we've got available whenever you need it because I'm not you. I don't like pain. I don't like to see patients in pain. And I want you to have the best experience that you could ever have. And sometimes that's having an epidural where you feel nothing.
Yeah.
And if you look at studies from years and years ago, we managed pain really well in hospitals in all areas except obstetrics, because we told women, you can do this natural, you don't need anything. Well, that's not true. Women don't like pain. You know, some women can do it without. Megan, no pain medications for all four of her deliveries. I think she had one dose of IV fentanyl with her first delivery. She was of the mindset with meditation and with breathing techniques, and some women can do that really well. Mm-hmm. Other women cannot. So I've had a number of women over the last 6 months who have done it with nothing. They use doulas, which is a labor support person that focuses just on the patient. You know, the husband or the other support person is there, but the doula is there to make you comfortable, help you with your breathing techniques. And there's good science behind the use of doula in labor support. You use less narcotics, you get less epidurals, you have less vaginal trauma. So there's lots of good evidence to support that. So again, if it works, use it. Mm-hmm. And so I really think that if you're open and you take the time, you're going to make that woman's experience in labor and delivery way better than if you just ignore a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. And do you allow women, because I remember I talked to a friend and she was like, they wouldn't let me move. I had to lay on my back and that was the position I had to be in. And I think that that's a little traumatic, right? If you're not allowed to move and you're not allowed to like be in this experience with the body that you're that is happening.
Women need to find the position that is most comfortable for them. I had a delivery last night just after midnight. She was in hands and knees for about 20 minutes just to get into a more comfortable position to relieve some of the pressure. She did great. You know, I've delivered women with, you know, their knees together, but in a squatting position, holding onto a bar or in hand knees. You just make do. Yeah. Is it easier to do it when they're on their back and their legs are up in stirrups? Yeah. But that's not always the best position for that woman to be in. So you really need to be open. And I think so many physicians get into that mindset that this is how I was trained. You have to be in, you know, a semi-Fowler's position where you're on your backs, a little bit inclined, legs up in the air. No. You can deliver in multiple different positions on your side, on your hands and knees, you know.
Yeah, that would just be another case of a provider making their training and their technique more important than what's comfortable for the patient.
Exactly.
And in all these centers that claim to be patient-centered in their care, yet if it doesn't match a technique, I'm not going to allow you to do it. I think people need to get their priorities a little more straight. But
I think if physicians or providers look at it as, we're going to provide the best care we can for you in the safest way. Mm-hmm. So if it's reasonable for you to do something, and I think that your baby's going to tolerate that, let's try it. If I've got a baby that's compromised and the patient wants to get up and walk around, I'm probably not going to let her do it. Or if she wants to be off the monitor and we're having a concerning strip, I'm probably not going to encourage her to do that. But again, you can't force anybody to do anything.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's their body, it's their life. So you just try to educate and educate and tell them, if this happens, we might have to do this, if that. So I spend 15 to 20 minutes with every patient in early labor to discuss, okay, this is what could lead to a C-section. You know, these four things is the most common reason for going to C-section. And we're going to talk about it now when everything's calm, so that if I come in and say, Shelly, this is going on, we need to go to the operating room, you're going to know why, because we talked about it before. You know, so again, it's, you have to take that time with those patients and educate them on why you're doing something, because it's like an assault otherwise.
You mentioned something earlier too of like, when you don't do as much fetal monitoring and there's the ability for the, you can have more natural labor. And you said something about a tub. Like, do you guys do that in the hospital?
We do. We do. So each of our labor and delivery rooms have a full-size bathtub.
Wow.
And with a detachable shower head. So again, good literature that supports submersing in water helps relieve some of the labor pains, particularly in that earlier phase of labor. If the baby's doing well, we'll take women, put them in the tub for a half hour, 40 minutes, and the nurses can spot check the baby with a little Doptone to make sure everything's going well. And if they're comfortable, they can be there as long as they want.
Can they deliver there?
So we don't do water births at our center because the bathrooms aren't big enough, and it's really it would compromise to have the nurse in there and the doctor. It's just not. But there are a couple facilities in the Twin Cities. Woodwinds Hospital in Woodbury, they have water births. So they have special rooms where they have tubs set up where the access for the nurse and the patient and the provider are excellent. So you can deliver the baby right in the water. You know, they're coming from water, they're going into water, so they're not going to breathe until you bring them out of the water. I've never had, I did one of those when I was in my fellowship because we did have a birthing tub. It's a little messy. And it's something that it's like, you know, when you look back in the 1960s and 70s at some of the films, providers actually climbed into these tubs with the patients and everybody was naked. It's like,
everyone in the amniotic fluid.
I know. Count me out. But, you know, reaching my arms into something like that is not a big deal. But so we don't have those capabilities here in Princeton. But there lots of places do water births.
And I think that's like a draw that I hear, at least for like wanting to do it at home and having your tub and having your space and all of that and having that natural ability for the baby to go into water, since, as you said.
Yeah. When you can do tub soaks or you can get up and walk around, we have birthing balls. So like the big exercise balls. We do a lot of pelvic rotations, you know.
Pelvic tilts and stuff.
Pelvic tilts and... teach them how to rock on the ball to get babies to change position, especially if the baby is in an unusual position. And those sorts of things really are helpful. And the nurses are so good at that, getting women up out of bed before they get their epidural. You know, once you get an epidural, you have to stay in bed because your legs are so weak. But they use peanut balls, which are like an exercise ball shaped in the shape of a peanut. And that helps change pelvic shape. You know, so you can get babies to rotate. They rotate moms a lot. So lots of techniques that the nurses use with the patients to get them comfortable and to get babies to descend into the pelvis and things like that.
Yeah. And I've heard that about the midwives too, is like they have just all these incredible techniques of positioning that say OB or a family practice doc spend some time with them. They would probably learn so much about this different positioning stuff.
Exactly.
So many things that you've been bringing up have to do with education, you know, prenatal education specifically in this critical time when the baby's growing. And you've talked a little bit about how that's one place that we have issues with the access and people who just can't get that prenatal access, the education to the prenatal care and everything that they need. So they just show up at the hospital like ready to birth and they haven't had any care throughout their whole pregnancy.
Yeah. And those are the women that are at highest risk for complications because a lot of those women who have had no access to care, so they haven't had any blood pressure monitoring, they haven't done any testing for gestational diabetes. They may have, you know, if they're over the age of 35, those women are at higher risk for things like that. So they're the train wrecks that come in and their pressures are super high or their uterus is contracting so strongly that the placenta is separating because their blood pressure is out of control. So you have a placental abruption or, you know, things like that. And that's what leads to higher morbidity and mortality with the neonates when you have no prenatal care. Because you're not getting them in early to educate them on, okay, this is how much weight I want you to gain. This is how I want you to eat. You need to be doing something aerobically for 20 to 30 minutes every day. You know, limiting your weight gain. You know, women who are heavy to start with shouldn't gain 50 or 60 more pounds because that increases their risk for hypertension, gestational diabetes. Dystocia. Dystocia means problems coming through the birth canal. Women gain weight everywhere. You can gain weight in the pelvis and even the vagina so that it prohibits that baby from coming through the birth canal.
I've heard you talk a little bit about the misconception of the myth, like, oh, I'm eating for two now. And people will say that.
Yeah, that's what I would hear growing up all the time.
So to gain 30 pounds in a pregnancy, you have to increase your calories by 300 per day over that 9-month period. That's a Snickers bar.
Yeah, exactly.
So when people say, oh, I'm eating for two, I correct them right away. I said, no, you're not. You should be eating like you were previously. Women who are overweight, I encourage not to gain any weight. Now, a dietitian might argue with me because they feel that even 15 or 20 pounds of weight gain is going to give that baby better nutrition. My theory, and I think there's some research to back this, is that with prenatal vitamins, where you're getting the micronutrients and the minerals and the vitamins that may be lacking in your diet, because the baby's a parasite. It's sucking from you, taking from you what it needs. It takes the calcium, it takes the iron, it takes all of the elements, the amino acids that it needs to grow from the woman. That's all in your fat stores.
And all the energy, the glucose, all of that is through the blood.
Through the blood. And so a normal, healthy Mediterranean type diet is very adequate for proper baby growth. You know, I've had women lose 60 to 80 pounds during a pregnancy and still deliver 7 to 8 pound babies because they're taking their prenatal vitamins, they're eating a healthy diet, but they've cut back significantly and the baby is just taking from them what it needs.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different ways of approaching it. I always just tell women, you know, the more you gain, the more you have to lose after the baby's born, you know, so we're going to monitor it. And I am a good babysitter and cheerleader, you know, so I encourage to push the plate over to the husband or the boyfriend or the other significant other that they may be with if they're getting too full, because you don't want too much weight gain during pregnancy.
Yeah. And it just can't be comfortable either. I can't imagine. I mean, obviously hasn't happened yet, knock on wood. So, but I also, what about exercise? I think there's a lot of fear of exercise. And especially I am fortunate to have a lot of friends through the Instagram world where I love what they do and I highly support them, but they get so much pushback from general population who are not educated individuals usually, who have no idea. And they think you're going to hurt your baby. You're working out. Like, how can you be doing this? And they get a lot of pushback on that.
Right. So this is the general thought with exercise and pregnancy. Aerobic exercise during pregnancy is excellent. So 20 to 30 minutes of walking or some sort of aerobic activity is considered very healthy for a pregnancy. You're going to be healthier. You're going to have a healthier pregnancy in general. You're not going to gain as much weight and your baby is going to be healthier. I tell women, if you have been doing a certain activity up until the time you got pregnant, you can continue that. If you've been going to CrossFit, if you've been doing yoga, if you've been doing Pilates, continue to do that. If you haven't, don't start a high impact aerobic program.
Totally.
You know, you're not going to start training for a marathon when you're 9 weeks pregnant if you haven't been running 6 miles a day. I've had women run up to 6 to 12 miles a day up until they deliver because they've been doing it. Their body is used to that. Their body is cooperating with that. My caveat to that is that if you continue doing something and you start having pain or you start having some cramping or you know, any cramping, bleeding, or change in discharge, we're going to stop and reevaluate and see what you're doing. There are certain things that women should not do during pregnancy that can increase their risk of falling and injury and causing harm to the pregnancy. Horseback riding, you know, riding motorcycle, riding bike, even. So things that you have an increased risk of falling off of or hurting yourself or injuring your abdomen. So I usually limit them to walking, riking, running, stationary bikes, workout programs, you know, at the gym are
weightlifting.
Fine. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's like such an important message to continue to promote because we should be wanting to have a healthy lifestyle all throughout.
Yes.
Right? It doesn't start at pregnancy and it doesn't start after pregnancy. It's any time throughout and we can maintain.
Yep. And I think it's important when people ask me, what do I do? You know, I am very fit for somebody my age.
Yes, you know, you can say it, brag about it.
I, you know, at 58, this is the best shape I've ever been in because I eat well. And yeah, I cheat. I love my chocolate and I love my pastries.
We had so many cupcakes.
Oh my gosh.
I know. Every time I come over, I can grab a Reese's at your place.
I know. But I do something physical every day. Yeah. And that's for me, I've realized that if I don't, I'm going to be 50 pounds heavier than I am now. And so I really model everything that I ask my patients to do. And I think that's really important.
Yeah.
If I were 300 pounds and I'm telling you to go out and walk 30 minutes a day and I'm not doing it myself, I'm a hypocrite, you know? So I really need to model, my behavior models what I'm asking my patients to do. And so I never ask anybody to do anything that I am not doing or I wouldn't do myself.
Absolutely. No, and I think that just goes along with the education. Like, I mean, once they trust the education, then they're more apt to maybe do it themselves. And if they trust you and see that you're doing the things yourself, then they might just be more apt to actually make that behavior change. And a lot of what we've talked about has been about education, specifically prenatal education. So what would you say are, like, I know we've probably touched on them, but are there, are some of them, but what are like the biggest tips you constantly find yourself giving people who are pregnant or want to be?
It's really about eating well and staying active. I'm just a huge, and I love the fact that I can follow you guys on Instagram. You know, I mean, I didn't know who you were, Jen, before Dom introduced me to you. And it's interesting how many of my patients were following you before
you knew.
I knew you.
Yeah.
And so mobility. I mean, for me, I talk to patients because women who are pregnant gain weight, they get uncomfortable, they want to stop moving, their pelvis hurts. So I talk to them about mobility stuff. I have referred more patients to your Instagram site just because it works.
Yeah.
I'm doing your mobility stuff, you know, and it helps me. It helps my husband. You know, we see the benefits of that. And it's just a new approach to, you know, Dominic always used to say, lotion is your motion. You've got to keep moving. So I really encourage watching what you eat, limiting your calories, and moving, you know, and that's with all my patients. I have a famous saying, you can ask any of the medical students that have worked with me for the last 23 years, and the majority of all of my patients, what's one thing that Fraboni says to you when you're in the office with him? Shut your mouth and move your fat ass. I don't care how thin or heavy you are. You know, I had somebody in today that's 121 pounds and she doesn't exercise.
Yeah.
And I looked at her and said, you know what? I'm going to say this to you too. Shut your damn mouth, move your fat ass, because if you're eating the wrong things and you're not moving, you're going to gain weight. I don't care how old you are, or eventually it's going to catch up with you. And that's kind of my motto in life. You know, yep, I treat myself. I don't deprive myself of the things that I really love, but I really limit it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's a balance in all of it, and it's continuing to work on that. I think that's different for every person, right? Because you don't want them to fall into disordered eating.
Right.
Right. Exactly. And so that's why I think it's healthy. Like, I appreciate coming over to your place and seeing the candy bowl that's out. And it doesn't mean you're going to eat the whole candy bowl, but can you have like one to two a day and still making sure that you're moving and still making sure you're getting the nutrients in and all of the other, you know, stuff that goes along with it. Like that, I think that's an important message. And I appreciate that you referred to my page. Thank you. But I was going to ask too, do you refer to pelvic floor therapy?
I do. Mm. We have a couple physical therapists in our practice that specialize in pelvic health for women. And so I really see a benefit there. And, you know, surgery isn't always the intervention that anybody needs. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes, yes, you definitely need it. But with proper training and education, pelvic health is really important. You know, pelvic relaxation in pregnancy is a huge problem, but pelvic strengthening exercises, you know, even just simple Kegel exercises during pregnancy could help with some of that pelvic floor health, you know? So I'm not an expert by any means, so I just refer to our physical therapists that specialize in that. And so, yeah, I definitely think it's beneficial.
100%.
Pelvic floor therapy. It's the new hot thing in PT. I feel like so many people coming up are like, oh, I want to specialize in pelvic floor therapy. But it's also so shocking to me that it's not something that was just regularly done. I mean, I feel like we focus so much on that education in the prenatal stage that once the mom was born, like for a long time, it was just like, okay, go home. Don't do much for
six weeks.
And then
once you have a baby that you're going to take care of.
And then resume life. It's like now we're being a little more tactical when we discharge people with their education.
You know, and there is trauma involved with vaginal birth.
Yep.
And there are lots of women that end up having dyspareunia or painful intercourse or just pelvic pain following a vaginal delivery, even following a C-section, because, you know, even though you're not delivering through the vagina, you're still that your pelvis has been definitely affected during the pregnancy. And so those women, if they come in at their 6-week postpartum exam and they're having any symptoms of pelvic discomfort, off to the PT they go to get some education and just learning the techniques that they can do at home.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's just so, like, I even tell humans, like, men have pelvic floors too. Yeah. You know, like, even just seeing a pelvic health therapist at least once every, even if, like, I went to see a friend and just to see what she does and how she does and everything, which might sound weird, but it was all good. And it was just fascinating for me to be able to learn about my pelvic health in that way, because it's not just about the strength, but it's about, like you said, relaxation. It's about the endurance. It's about movement with your pelvic health. And there's so many layers to it that I feel like even before you get pregnant, just go see what's happening. When no one ever, you know, we get our hands put on our back and our shoulders and on these places that we can externally feel, but we don't get any feedback to our pelvic health until we have a baby pulled out of us or something. Right. And I just think it's so important to get that tactical feedback and have working with someone so you could just start to learn, and then maybe you don't have to go back and see them, you know, but at least you start to have an understanding.
So normally this is the point where we ask where people can find you online and that kind of thing. I know that you don't have a massive social media presence out there yet. Haven't gotten hip with that.
No,
I don't. You do follow on us and creep us, though.
I do. I creep on you guys and lots of people on social media. I, you know, I'm a family physician with the special OB privileges here in Princeton, Minnesota. My business is by word of mouth, essentially. So for 25 years, all of my patients typically are referred to me by people that have experienced my care.
And for your future DocBod program that we'll put together for you.
Yes.
Like you were talking about in the episode, you don't ask anything of anyone that you don't do. And eventually I think you're going to put out a program that people can follow.
Yeah.
Called the Fraboni DocBod.
Yeah.
How to get a six pack in your late 50s.
Yeah. It's so many comments from my friends. Is that your dad or your brother?
I know. Every time you post.
I read through some of those last night. I was like, I love all these people. I want to be their friends.
Oh, that's
so
fun.
Great.
Well, thanks for being here and just talking through all this stuff having to do with pregnancy and the world of working in hospitals and cross-pollination amongst providers. I think you have such a cool and unique perspective coming from a rural area, having done what you've done for so long. Having the training that you have, it was just really cool to dive into some of those things.
It's so critical to be collaborative. And it's where we make the most mistakes in medicine, where we work against each other instead of with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that everybody in the hospital is my equal and that I know people's names because they're important and their job makes my job even better. And my experience with them is great. And so, yeah, it's, we just have to be kind and we have to do what's right for the patient.
How amazing is my father-in-law? I mean, I'm so blessed that I get to call him family now. So smart, so much good information. I hope you enjoyed this. Please share it with anyone that you know who wants to get pregnant, who is pregnant. This is such valuable information. There's so much dichotomy of what is right, what is wrong. But if we don't all just work together in raising healthy bodies so we can raise healthy babies. That's the key. So if you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast, we have so much amazing interviews, but also just educational pearls about the body and diagnoses that you can learn. So if you haven't yet subscribed, leave us a review. It really helps us to get seen by so many other people. And I hope that you're continuing to enjoy it. We love hearing from you. So keep listening.